Class is back in session. It's time for Baptist Basics University from BaptistBasics.org.
Welcome back to another episode of BaptistBasics.org as we kick off a new series as we study through the book of Daniel. I'm excited about this. What I'm doing, and I'm Matthew Gage, by the way, I think I forgot to say that. What I'm doing is I've been teaching in Sunday school and taught through the book of Acts, which I've already covered in our in the Baptist Basics University series. So I was asked to go through the book of Daniel, which really, wow, what a challenge that is. So what I'm doing is kind of getting double duty here and developing notes, and you're going to use those for both the Sunday school and to do this series here. So I thought for a while about maybe using the recordings and recording, you know, me teaching, actually teaching it, you know, live in church, but decided I'll just want to keep this series of podcasts, keep it the way it is, the same production, the same sound and same quality. And besides, I'm afraid if something went wrong, I'd end up sitting right here and recording it anyway. So I think this will just keep everything nice and consistent. And plus, you know, this will be the second time I've gone through most of this, so it shouldn't have any of the same hiccups and same mistakes that I made the first time through. So you ought to be getting the better of the two times I go through this. But anyway, the book of Daniel, wow, what a challenge this is. And this first lesson is we just kind of introduce the book. And really, when I say introduce the book, we're going to kind of give an overview, talk about a little bit about Daniel. We're going to talk a lot of history. This introduction is mainly just a historical introduction to the book, laying the background for Babylon, how this fits into the historical outline of the scripture. That's mainly what we're going to be doing today. And then I have not completely decided, I'm only, you know, a couple lessons into this as I record this and developing my notes, where my plan is to cover at least the first six chapters in one lesson apiece. And I may, kind of depending on once I get there, when we get to the second half of the book, which the last six chapters, which are more prophetic, I may get away from doing one lesson per chapter, depending on some of the subject matter. And we'll see how that goes as I just develop the notes. Also, there is a possibility I may actually do a second introduction lesson, an introduction lesson just on the prophetic section of Daniel. So I'm going to go ahead and call this just the introduction to the book of Daniel, and we'll just kind of consider it a historical introduction if I do go ahead and do the second introduction lesson to the second half of the book. Generally, when you hear the book of Daniel, what should pop in your mind? Well, the book of Daniel is the history, the story, mainly of a young man who was a Jew who was taken captive to Babylon, was trained by them, became a leader in their government, and who was a steadfast and faithful man of God. And this is a story about him and his friends, the rulers he encountered, God's dealings with them. And further than that, it's also the story of the prophecies that were revealed to Daniel. And whether through dreams, such as Nebuchadnezzar having a dream and Daniel interpreting that, and then also things that were revealed directly to Daniel, just and those histories are amazing because they are an outline of history, really from the next 500-600 years, especially after Daniel, to but even into the end times events. And when I say that, the book of Daniel is a key prophetic book. You really can't even understand the book of Revelation properly without having an understanding of the book of Daniel. The two really go hand in hand. As I say, in the prophecies, it lays out a timeline, description of coming world empires, gets in a little bit into the end times and the Antichrist, but just some amazing detailed prophecies, the most amazing of which to me is the prophecy of the 70 weeks. And when we get to that, that might be where we may need to devote an entire lesson just to that prophecy and really, you know, split that out of take it out of the chapter and spend a lot more time dealing with it. And anyway, but that's just kind of a broad overview of what the book of Daniel is. Who wrote the book of Daniel? Conservative scholarship says that Daniel was written by Daniel, which is kind of funny when you think about it. He writes about himself in the third person. But anyway, we as conservative, I won't say I'm a conservative scholar, that sounds bad, but I believe Daniel probably wrote it. If not, it was someone who was familiar with him, close to him. Anyway, I do believe Daniel probably wrote it. Who was Daniel? Well, like I said before, he was taken captive probably as a teenager. Guesses are anywhere from, you know, 10, 12 up to 16, 18, somewhere in there. But most people guess that he was probably a teenager. Was taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar during his first siege of Jerusalem in 605 BC. And we'll talk a little bit more about that towards the end of the lesson. But he was taken captive out of the kingdom of Judah to the land of Babylon. These captives that were taken, they were royal, they were talented. We may look at a little bit of the description of them. In fact, we will in Daniel chapter 1 get a little bit of description, some of the qualification that these captives had to have. And they were taken. These were the best and the brightest. They were taken to be trained and then integrated into Babylonian society and government. They were trained in the education system of Babylon, trained in the Babylonian science, and which was pretty much the height of academia at the time. And we'll get a little bit about that in the next lesson. Daniel's name means roughly God is judge, or God is my judge, or God has judge, something along those lines. But Daniel basically means God is judge, which I think is kind of interesting when you step back and say, when you're looking at the book of Daniel and the history involved, we see that God is in control. We see God judging and God's judgment upon the world, upon individuals. So just a little bit deeper meaning even to that name when it's applied to this book. Historically and biblically, Daniel is referenced a couple of other times. And his prophecies a little bit more, you know, say, like you get into Revelation, so there's some allusions back to it. But Ezekiel, who is a contemporary of Daniel, their ministries overlap, refers to him twice. In Ezekiel chapter 14 and verse 14, says, though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness, saith the Lord God. So in this case, Ezekiel writing groups in Daniel amongst two other legendary figures in the Bible. Noah, the only righteous man in his day, and Job, the righteous, you know, man who suffered. That is some elite company that Daniel is grouped in with. Also, he's referenced in Ezekiel chapter 28. And I didn't put a bookmark on this one. I'll flip over to it. Chapter 28, verse 3 says, behold, thou art wiser than Daniel. There is no secret that they can hide from thee. So here's an allusion to Daniel's wisdom. And Daniel, I believe, was a brilliant man, was probably a genius as far as, you know, physically, worldly, psychologically, you know, however you want to put that. A natural man, we could say. But his gifts and abilities go far beyond that, because in the spiritual sense, God mightily used this man Daniel and in prophecies, interpreting dreams and things like that. Interestingly also is that Daniel is quoted by Jesus Christ himself in Matthew 24 and verse 15. It says, when ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. And I'll quit reading there, but spoken of by Daniel the prophet. So here is Christ himself going back and saying, oh yes, remember that abomination, desolation. We'll get into that. That's in the second half of the book. But, you know, Daniel the prophet spoke about that. He wrote about that. He's the one that talked about that. So Christ himself puts a stamp of approval on Daniel and his ministry and the reliability of his prophecies. And as far as Daniel also into his life, Daniel lived at least probably 80, 90 years. He lived throughout the 70-year captivity period. So most people guess he was, in his mid to late 80s, 90s. He lived to a ripe old age. He was, it seems to be, like a trusted advisor or administrator in the kingdom, was highly respected for his character, for his wisdom, and just a tremendous testimony that he had, even in a pagan society. He seems so well respected and so well loved. Now, when we're talking about the book of Daniel, the one thing that I feel compelled to mention is that the book of Daniel is one of the most, if not the most, debated book in the Bible. There is a tremendous battle and debate over this book, over its reliability, over its historical accuracy. And the prevailing modern thought on this book is that it is not authentic. That, and I'm saying this modern, the more modern consensus among so-called Bible scholars. I disagree with them in this. I'm going to say that plainly. But they say that the book of Daniel was probably written in the first or second century, not back, as far back as the 6th century BC, I believe it would be probably 500s BC, something like that. So they say it was probably written in about 100 BC, and that it was written as Jewish propaganda, that this was a book that was just made up to help bolster support as the Jews were fighting for their independence and their identity against the Seleucid Empire and Antiochus Epiphanes, who this book talks about. Daniel talks about Antiochus Epiphanes and what he would do. He is a foreshadowing of the Antichrist, and I can't wait to get into all that history. But the modern thought by many scholars is that this book was written not hundreds of years before that. It was not prophecy, but that it was written as a fiction book around the time that those prophecies would be coming true, supposedly. So that's the modern thought on the book of Daniel. In fact, I'll be honest, like when I was going back and teaching through the book of Acts, websites that I found that were tremendous helps to me with historical information and, even some little bit on the theology side of things have been absolutely no help to me when I've studied this book of Daniel, because they take this position. Many skeptics in the past have tried to find historical inaccuracies in the book. They've said, well, there was no Belshazzar, no historical proof of it. Well, the more that they've dug up, the more accurate the Bible has appeared. And for instance, I'll go ahead and mention it. Let me flip over to the book of Daniel. That way I don't mess all this up. But in Daniel and chapter number 5, the story of the handwriting on the wall and Belshazzar, who's the king, and he sees the writing on the wall and he needs somebody to interpret it. And they bring in Daniel, and he tells Daniel, or he even tells them that that, you know, if he can do this, he can be, boy, I don't see the verses skimming through here, but he even says, you know, I'll make you the third ruler in the kingdom. Okay, it's in verse 7. Talks about, you know, and he shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. He's going to reward whoever can interpret this writing with being the third highest ranking official in the kingdom. The reason why, they used to think, well, this Belshazzar guy never existed. Well, here's the deal. Belshazzar did exist. They've now dug up evidence that he did exist. Wow, that's amazing. The Bible's right. Well, of course it's right. But in just further accuracy of the Bible, when it talks about being the third ruler in the kingdom, the reason why he couldn't make someone the second ruler is because he was the second ruler. His, I believe it actually was his dad, was still around, was actually still in charge. They were co-rulers. So when he said, I'll make you the third ruler, that's the highest honor he could bestow, was just to make someone number three because he was number two. So, you know, that kind of stuff people have poked holes at or tried to poke holes at in the book of Daniel and different things, even with the linguistics and the language. The language is kind of, it's amazing. It's partly in Hebrew, partly in, I believe it's Aramaic. There's a few Persian words, and there's just a mixture of even some other things. So even linguistically, it's a very interesting book to be studied on that level. And so people have tried to poke holes and say, well, oh, the, you know, based on the language, it couldn't have been written at the time and blah, blah, blah. Well, listen, I'm simple when it comes to faith, and I take God's word at face value, and I believe faith value. That actually would sound pretty good. But I do believe that the book of Daniel is what it says it is. And that is that this is a historically accurate book about a historical person who lived through these times, who knew these kings, who was in this position, who had these prophecies that would be fulfilled hundreds of years into his future. That's what I believe about the book of Daniel. And if that offends you, there's plenty of other sources out there if you want to keep studying the book of Daniel from the modern critical standpoint. But I take the Bible at face value. I believe what it says. And I believe there was this man named Daniel, that he probably wrote this book, or else it was written about a real person, and that these prophecies are real. They don't date back to the first or second century BC. They date back probably to Daniel's lifetime when they were actually written down. So anyway, that's my rant on Daniel. And let me point this out too. Let's not leave this subject just yet. It's funny to me, the two books that critics like to laugh at and scoff at the most in the Old Testament. Well, Genesis and the creation account, that gets quite a bit, but I'm not really counting that. But they are the book of Jonah and the book of Daniel. You know what's funny, though? Two prophets that Christ himself quotes and validates specifically are Jonah and Daniel. So if you believe Jesus Christ was the Son of God, evidently he believed that Jonah and Daniel were real people, and what the Bible says about them and what their recorded words, he believed that they were accurate also. So Christ gives his approval to there being a Daniel, that he was a prophet, and that his prophecies were true. So if you don't believe the Bible itself, well, do you believe Jesus Christ, the Son of God? If you don't believe him, then we've got bigger issues. But you can't have one or the other. Okay, let's look at real quick just an outline of the book of Daniel. The first six chapters are historical. We see, and I've just kind of given some titles, especially when we get to the prophetic section. It's kind of hard to put just a title on this. But chapter one is Daniel and his friends tested. This is where Daniel purposed he wouldn't eat the king's meat. That's chapter one. Chapter two is the story of the great image that Nebuchadnezzar, the dream that he has, and Daniel interprets it. Chapter three is the fiery furnace where they build the image that everyone's supposed to worship, and the three Hebrew boys, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, otherwise known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, refuse to bow down and thrown in the fiery furnace. All this is such great classic Sunday school stories. I just want to start acting them out. Chapter four is the humbling of Nebuchadnezzar. Probably of all the stories in the book of Daniel, that one's overlooked the most, where Nebuchadnezzar basically loses his mind and is humbled before God, and finally comes back to his senses. Chapter four. Chapter 5, which I've already looked at, is the story of the handwriting on the wall, and it's the fall of the Babylonian Empire. Chapter 6 is the story of Daniel in the lion's den, which, you know, you think about it, we hadn't got there yet, but chapter 6, and Daniel in the lion's den, most people picture Daniel as being, you know, the teenager. Actually, that's at the end of his life. He's probably 80, 90 years old at the time being thrown in there. He's actually an old man. So that's the first six chapters. The next six chapters, chapters 7 through 12, are the prophetic section of Daniel. And these are not, chapters 1 through 6 are pretty much chronological in how they order. Chapters 7 through 12, all this doesn't happen after chapter 6. These kind of go back. It's just separated kind of by subject matter. So these kind of go back, and if you were building a timeline of the book of Daniel, these would occur in between chapters 1 through 6. So, in chapter 7, we have the vision of the four beasts, which is another interpretation, another illustration of the great image that Nebuchadnezzar saw about the four coming kingdoms. Chapter 8, the ram and the he-goat, gets in a little bit about Antiochus Epiphanes and things like that. Chapter 9 is the vision of the 70 weeks, and can't wait to get into that. Chapter 10 is Daniel's prayer and the angels speaking to him, stuff. That's chapter 10. Chapter 11, the little horn, more prophecies kind of about the Antichrist, and we'll see. I'm going off the top of my head on that, and I haven't got that far studying, but the little horn is Antichrist, Alexander the Great, Antiochus Epiphanes, more historical prophecies involved there. I probably just messed all that up. I'm just riffing off the top of my head. And then chapter 12 is just kind of a little further look into the end times, wrapping up the book of Daniel. And as I say, those are, for the most part, way oversimplified. I just tried to find something really quick, something easy to remember from those chapters, just to give you an idea of what was going on, something kind of easy to remember. But anyway, that's outline of the book of Daniel. So next, what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the history of the Babylonian Empire. The Bible is not necessarily a history book, but there's a lot of history involved. And I think to understand the Bible, you need to understand history and understand where things are coming from. And so what I'd like to do is, you know, the bulk of Daniel takes place in the days of the height of the Babylonian Empire. So we're going to look at the history of it, where they came from, and talk about that, because I think that will help you understand kind of where these people come from and what's been going on and kind of their place in the progression of kingdoms. Now, according to the Bible, if you go back to Genesis chapter 10, verses 8 through 10, I'll flip back there. I don't have that bookmarked either, but I'll flip back there real quick. But it says that this was a city that was established by Nimrod. And in chapter, it says, "And Cush begot Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth." Verse 9, "He was a mighty hunter before the Lord, wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord." Chapter verse 10, "And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar." Okay, now the biblical ancient name for this area around Babylon is Shinar, so that you see that come up quite a bit. But that town there, Babel, Bible scholars and people point to that and say, well, that is Babylon, that is the city that it was established all the way back under Nimrod. Now, the ancient sources, ancient historians and people that we have, you know, secular sources, will date this time to around the founding of Babylon to about 2231 to 2286 BC. There's some variational dates. There probably was, you know, a village and other things there before that, but the actual founding of the city itself, the city proper, setting up kind of a city state, revolves or is somewhere in that time period in mid 2200 BC. Historians that have studied the Babylonian Empire will divide it up in a few different periods. The oldest is the Old Babylonian period, and they'll say that this was the first kind of power period that it had. It was established by an Amorite chieftain named Samu-Abum. I just love that name, Samu-Abum, in around 1894 BC. And this was a period where Babylon was a pretty powerful city-state, had some influence in the area, and actually controlled quite a bit of region. The most famous ruler of this time is a guy that if you've studied history, if you've studied law, if you've studied architecture of government buildings, you may have heard of. His name is Hammurabi, or I don't know, there's different ways to say that. But he ruled from about 1792 to 1750 BC, and he's famous for the Code of Hammurabi, and where he took all these laws and stuff, and what we'd say is codified them, and put them down in stone and set up, you know, monuments with the law inscribed in them. And very famous that they found, and a lot of people like to compare and contrast this historically to, you know, Moses' law. But of all the early rulers, he's the only one that really people have ever heard of, or even historically we might say that really matters to modern society. But anyway, Hammurabi would fall into this Old Babylonian period. During this time, they're constantly being conquered. Some groups that came in and conquered them, the Hittites from up in Asia Minor, a group called the Kassites, the Elamites, the Assyrians. And the Assyrians, you know what, I haven't talked about really where Babylon itself is in modern day Iraq. Ancient Babylonia basically take the Euphrates and Tigris rivers, and that area around those rivers is kind of a very narrow area. But that, right there around those rivers is what's known as, you know, Babylonia, and so that's what we're talking about, because Assyria is, you know, a little bit further to the northwest from there. And but anyway, they are kind of ushering the next period of Babylonian Empire, where the Assyrians are in control, and Babylon is a kind of a vassal state to them. Now, that doesn't mean that they were very calm. They rebelled many times. But from about 911 to 608 BC, Assyria was the major world power, major area power, and they controlled the region of Babylonia, controlled the city of Babylon. Now, like I said, there were many times they revolted. In fact, the Assyrians got so fed up that in 689, they came in and just leveled the city. They got so tired of them, you know, rebelling, that they just leveled the place. So finally, in 612, so, you know, just about 70 years after that, a guy named Nabopolassar, comes into power and leads the Babylonians into gaining independence from Assyria. And Nabopolassar establishes the next period, which is what's called the Neo-Babylonian Empire, or the Neo-Babylonian Chaldean Empire, or the Babylonian Chaldean Empire, a bunch of different names for it. But this is the height of power, and this is the time period that the Book of Daniel opens in. from about 612 to 539 BC is kind of the dates for this period where Babylon was the world power. They end up defeating the Assyrians and conquering them. They fought to a stalemate with Egypt, and basically Egypt stayed down in Egypt and quit trying to mess around in the modern Middle East. And so Babylon eventually basically rules what we consider the Middle East, Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Syria and the Holy Land and up into Turkey and over towards Iran. That whole area was controlled by the Babylonians. Key rulers, Nabopolassar, he's a guy that really kicked things off and got, established it. His son is the one that took it to its greatest heights. He's called Nebuchadnezzar. And he kind of finished up mopping up with some of the military victories. Also was the key architect in building the city of Babylon. And because remember, we're not talking too many, less than 100 years before that the place had been leveled. So they, Nebuchadnezzar was building monuments and buildings and possibly even one of the seven wonders of the world. There's a lot of debate about whether it even existed or if it existed in Babylon, but the Hanging Gardens would have been built during this time if they existed. They were built by Nebuchadnezzar. Next major ruler would be, I'm skipping some, this isn't all of them, Nabonidus. He's the father of Belshazzar, and his son, Belshazzar, boy, that makes no sense in my notes. Yes, it does. What? No, it doesn't. Okay, don't you love when you look at your notes and they make no sense? But anyway, Nabonidus, his son was Belshazzar. That's where we already talked about in Daniel chapter, Daniel chapter 5. Nabonidus was the king. Belshazzar was also king, but was kind of a sub-king under make him was his regent, something like that. And Belshazzar was the last ruler standing when the Medes and the Persians came in and conquered them, which ushers in the next period, which Daniel lived to see the first few years of. And this would be the Persian period. Cyrus the Great of Persia, with an alliance with the Medes, came in and conquered Babylon in 539. Amazing. The whole battle there is amazing. Can't wait to really cover that in depth. But basically they came in and the city itself was too heavily fortified. They couldn't really just directly assault it. But the river Euphrates ran through the city. They had walls built around it, but they had built it so the river ran under the walls and through the city. So what Cyrus's men do is go in and dig canals and reroute the Euphrates River and then go through the walls where the river went through the walls and attack and capture the city. So just really cool battle. It's just an amazing battle plan and have the manpower, and that's without bulldozers and TNT and stuff like that. That's just backbreaking labor. They dug canals and rerouted one of the major rivers in the area. But anyway, during this time period, Babylon becomes kind of like the administrative center for the Persian Empire. It's not necessarily the capital. It's more of a regional capital. Also, is still exalted for its learning and academia and things like that. There's a few attempts where they tried to revolt, but nothing really got off the ground, and those failed. Of course, if you know ancient history, any of the Persians were finally defeated by the Greeks, a fellow named Alexander the Great. In 331, he defeats Darius III and so takes over the area of Babylon. An interesting note is that Alexander the Great dies in Babylon. He actually died in Nebuchadnezzar's palace in 323 BC. So just to kind of further tie all these historical figures together. After the death of Alexander the Great during this Greek period, the city really just begins to lose importance and fall into desolation till there comes a point to where it's basically just desolate. Maybe some of the religious activities are keeping some people around, but as a major city, it ceased to be one during this time. It's kind of caught in the middle of the different warring factions after Alexander the Great, and just falls into desolation. Now, the province around Babylon, Babylonia, that will remain a region or a province for centuries later, under Persia, even under Arabian control. So, there's kind of, still echoes of the former glory of the Babylonian Empire, in that region. But by then, is Babylon, the city itself, is, nothing like it was before. And then I'll throw in also just to hit another kind of neat little historical side note, is that fast forward to modern times, Saddam Hussein actually had some building projects in Babylon. I said Babylon is in modern day Iraq, and was building, trying to rebuild parts of the city, and wanted to build it up, kind of reestablish. He saw himself as a new Nebuchadnezzar, and had some bricks stamped with his name on them like Nebuchadnezzar used to do, and a bunch of kind of crazy things like that as he kind of thought he was returning Iraq to the former glory of the Babylonian Empire. Of course, we know how that worked when, the U.S. finally quit playing around and did their job and finished him off. But anyway, that's just an extra little side note. All right, the last thing I want to cover is how this fits into how the relationship with Israel and Babylon, how that plays out. And kind of where this fits into the history of Israel. So what we're going to be focusing on that, that Neo-Babylonian Empire, the time of Nebuchadnezzar, that's what we're talking about here. Basically, the land of Israel is kind of caught in between a bunch of major, at least regional powers. To the north, there was Assyria. To the east, there is Babylon. To the southwest, there is Egypt. And the land of Israel is just caught in the middle. Now, of course, after Solomon died and the kingdom split, the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah, the northern kingdom of Israel is conquered by the Assyrians and kind of ceases existence. So when we're talking about here, we're talking about Israel, we're really focusing on the kingdom of Judah right there around Jerusalem. So what happens, and you can read about this, the last couple chapters of 2 Chronicles and 2 Kings kind of deal with this time period. In fact, 2 Kings 24 and 25, and 2 Chronicles chapter 36 kind of deal with this this historical period I'm talking about here. Babylon is starting to rise to power under Nabopolassar, under his son Nebuchadnezzar. And they're starting to make progress in defeating what had been the major power, Assyria. Now, you still have Egypt down there, North Africa, still major power, not at the height of its power by any means, but still a major, regional power. And they had been at war with Assyria. Well, they see the new threat in Babylon. So when Babylon starts making inroads in defeating Assyria, Egypt basically switches who their enemy is. They move Assyria down on the top 10 most wanted list and put Babylon as number one. And they decide, the biggest threat to their interests is Babylon, this rising power. So Egypt goes into attack. So in 2 Chronicles chapter 35, verses 20 through 24, we see that King Josiah, who was a good king, kind of made a foolish move. And as Egypt's army is going north to Assyria to help defend Assyria in 609 BC, Josiah leads the armies of Israel out against the army of Egypt and is soundly defeated. In fact, he loses his life in the battle, I believe. And, I mean, just a disastrous defeat for Israel and Egypt. Just, you know, doesn't even hardly faze them. They just move right on their mission, go up into Assyria, and leading to them being defeated, Egypt and Assyria both being defeated by the Babylonian army, who begin to move down into the Holy Land with the, you know, no one's there to stop them, so they start systematically taking over the Middle East and the Holy Land area. Now, Nebuchadnezzar kept pushing at the Egyptians and ends up pushing them back down, you know, into North Africa, into, you know, modern, what we think of as Egypt, and but could not defeat them. In 601 BC, they fight a battle that's not decisive. Neither side really claimed victory. Very costly on both sides, but basically what it did was establish a boundary, and Babylon and Egypt didn't mess with each other from that point on. But Egypt had lost and moved back down into their traditional territory and were not trying to do anything up in the Middle East any longer. So in that case, you could think, well, Nebuchadnezzar did win at least in the war. They may not have conquered Egypt, but they did push them out, and they, you know, were not a factor anymore. Under King Jehoiakim, Jerusalem finally falls to Babylon in 598 BC. The several thousand nobles are deported to Babylon, and that's covered in, you can read about that, Jeremiah 29 verse 2, Esther 2 verse 6. Yeah, okay. That just doesn't seem right. I'm going to look that up right now. This is some high quality, because that just does not seem right. That's Esther. High quality podcasting here. You're getting what you pay for as I look that up. 2 verse 6. Hey, what do you know? Yes, that is talking about that. Good, good, good. I shouldn't doubt my notes like that. So, all right. Anyway, under King Zedekiah, Judah will rebel against Babylon in 589. They're quickly defeated, and Jerusalem once again falls under siege in 587, and a second deportation takes place. This is this destruction. Not only does Jerusalem surrender, it is destroyed. And this is the prophet Jeremiah, who's been warning about this was coming, you know, that this judgment was coming and that, you know, the Babylonians would win. But after the destruction of Jerusalem in 587, this is where he writes the Book of Lamentations, mourning, Jerusalem's fall. Now, I just realized I think some of these dates may not completely jive with some of the stuff I said before, but it's kind of hard to get some of these timelines to match up, and these are just approximate numbers, but I got a feeling these didn't match up with some of the numbers I used right at the beginning of the lesson. Anyway, I keep getting sidetracked. I apologize. Just who I am. And if you've been listening for a while, you know what happens every now and then. The Jews would be captive to Babylon and then into Persia for 70 years. This is called the Babylonian captivity. Once the Persians are in control, they start allowing them to move back into the land, and this is, you know, post the Book of Daniel, but that's when you get in the Book of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther will all take place after this 70-year period. And a side note, much of Daniel's ministry involves, Jeremiah's ministry involves this Babylonian victory. about Judah's downfall and this captivity that they would go into. So just to give you an idea of where Daniel fits in the Bible, where it fits in the history of Israel, this is what is going on in the book of Daniel. You know, Israel, Judah, you know, they're not major players anymore. Babylon is the world power and really leads into, you know, for probably what, at least the next 600-700 years, where minus the little brief period under the Maccabees and their right there, where Israel is dominated by outside powers. And even during the Maccabee period, they really, their independence did revolve a lot of, you know, some of the deals they were able to cut and different things like that with, you know, Rome and, you know, even their very existence was with the Seleucids. It was deals they were able to cut with them. But anyway, but for pretty much the next 600-700 years, Israel is dominated by the Babylonians, next by the Persians, next by the Greeks, then by the Romans, until finally in 70 AD, the Romans come in and, you know, destroy Jerusalem, destroy the temple. And then the last little hurrah in 130 AD under Bar Kokhba, where kind of the final rebellion, and that's where basically they wipe Israel off the map and literally wipe them off the map. And no longer is it called Israel or Judea. It's now called Palestine. That's the name that it gains from that point on. They don't even want to call it Judea. They want to erase that memory out of their minds after the Bar Kokhba revolt. So anyway, going way too far in history there. But anyway, I just want to give you an idea of where Daniel fits in the history. This is what's going on, where Daniel's place is, the kingdom he is dealing with, where they've come from, how they fit into history. And Daniel's alive to witness some amazing things. You know, the history he sees and the kingdoms he sees and the conquerors he sees and, you know, all that pales in comparison to what God allowed him to see. And as we get into the book, just amazing how God used this man. It's amazing also I'm so in awe of Daniel, the man, his character, his integrity. Just an amazing, amazing individual. Must have been I believe he was a genius, an amazing person, and may be one, I don't want to say greatest Christian, because he wasn't a Christian. You know, he was a Jew. Maybe one of the most godly, God-fearing men that the world has ever seen. To think of his place, the people he's around, and yet just have the spotless testimony that he does. What an amazing individual, and I hope that you will enjoy our study of him as we progress through this, and we look at the stories of the historical period of the book and see what Daniel did, what happened to him, and then we get into the prophecies of the book of Daniel. So, exciting times. I'm thrilled to be doing this. It is I'm going to tell you, it's a challenge. It's a challenge that I am excited about undertaking to go through and explain the book of Daniel and teach through it. I hope that you will enjoy this. I know I enjoy the history. I enjoy the prophecy. So I think that you will too, and I hope some of that bleeds through to you. But anyway, that's it for today. I appreciate you listening today. Check out other resources on BaptistBasics.org and be on the lookout for the next lesson. That's it. I thank you for listening today. I hope it's been a help and a blessing to you. I'm Matthew Gage. Thanks for listening.